This podcast was recorded on Thursday, January 31st at 10:45 a.m. Things might have changed by the time you hear it.
Yeah, like it might have warmed up.
You mean you don't like wind chills of negative 30? Let's talk politics. This is Snollygoster, WOSU Public Media's weekly look at Ohio politics and those shrewd Snollygosters who make a living promising things to Ohio voters. I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Mike Thompson. Coming up later in the podcast, our Snollygoster of the Week wastes no time starting to climb the legislative ladder.
But first, there are issues for which there seems to be no political solution, like peace in the Middle East and abortion.
First, in number 70, 18... Roe against Wade. Mrs. Weddington, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
It never really seems to leave the news, so to say it is back in the news is not really accurate. But it is in the news this week because Ohio's leading anti-abortion group, Ohio Right to Life, says the heartbeat bill is its number one legislative priority.
And the heartbeat bill, of course, is a bill that would ban abortions in Ohio after the detection of a fetal heartbeat can come as early as 6 weeks into a pregnancy. Until now, Ohio Right to Life has remained neutral on the issue and, in fact, sometimes has quietly worked against it.
And now they have come out and said that because of the change in the Supreme Court, they are going to work for it. Joining us now to explain this a little bit more is OSU Law Professor Mark Spindleman. Mark, welcome to Snollygoster.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Back in 2013, you wrote a piece in a law journal, the OSU Law Journal, I believe, on the heartbeat bill. You pointed out that anti-abortion groups, if they did not oppose the heartbeat bill, they at least steered clear of it, fearing that if it went before the Supreme Court, it'd get shot down and strengthen Roe versus Wade. What's changed since then?
Well, most notably, what's changed is the composition of the Supreme Court of the United States and the retirement of Justice Anthony Kennedy, who was for a very long time regarded as the swing vote justice, the justice whose opinion, although all justices are made equally, the swing justice's opinion often, because it's the one that really is the deciding vote, matters distinctively. And his replacement and his departure from the court and his replacement with a justice who's even more conservative than he seems to have opened up potentially the door for new kinds of laws to be upheld.
So if the heartbeat bill had gone to the court with Justice Kennedy on it, the fear was that it would have been shot down. And that would have ended the debate?
Well, the fear was, or the hope was, that it would be so far out of line with existing case law that there was no way easily to square it without repudiating cases that Justice Kennedy, among others, had agreed to. So that prospect is no longer looking quite like it does. And so we're back in involved with the question of what's going to happen with measures like the heartbeat bill and others that are clearly out of the boundaries of existing Supreme Court case law.
Yeah. I've heard people on the anti-abortion side say that the Ohio heartbeat bill was specifically written to get before the Supreme Court, and it is better written to do so. Is this, quote unquote, the perfect bill to challenge Roe v. Wade?
Well, I mean, in a way, it's a perfect bill to cut back quite significantly on Roe against Wade. It might operate if it depends on how the court answers the question that the case involves, which is, in part, is viability the important dividing line that it's been in the Supreme Court's decisions for a considerable time, all the way back, in a sense, to Roe against Wade. This measure, going regulating women's reproductive choices as early in pregnancy, pre-viability as it does, looks to be deeply inconsistent with a rule that says the ultimate decision about whether to terminate an unwanted pregnancy before viability is the pregnant woman's. And in that sense, it looks like it will operate potentially if a decision upholds this, a Supreme Court decision upholds a measure like the heartbeat bill. It's really hard to square Roe against Wade with this one, but it's imaginable that there could be ways that Roe could be left on the books, but just be, in a sense, so broadly eviscerated that it's not necessary to take the final step and administer the final blow to the decision.
Is there a legal agreement on what viability is?
It's a standard sort of understanding of what it is. The idea back in the case law is sort of that point at which the fetus can exist outside of the womb. Of course, everybody understands that, you know, sort of that's not possible sort of in an independent way.
It's a case-by-case basis.
It is a case-by-case basis in an important respect, sort of what looks sort of and when and what stage of fetal development. But the idea of viability is not an especially, you know, sort of in the legal constitutional terms, is not an especially complicated one, and it's certainly clear that 6 weeks, 8 weeks, is well before the point of fetal viability.
It's usually in the 23-week range, and though technology has moved that back even further than it was in 1973.
That's right.
You know, Mark, it's been nearly 50 years since Roe versus Wade was decided, and it's still such a divisive topic. I think a clear but small majority of Americans believe abortion should be legal in some cases. Why haven't we been able to, as a society, as a political, you know, society, been able to solve this issue?
Well, I mean, the one of the major Supreme Court decisions, called Planned Parenthood against Casey, for short.
This was the 92.
Is the 92 case, which significantly cut back on the Supreme Court's earlier decision in Roe against Wade. The controlling opinion in that case was an unusual joint opinion by three justices, O'Connor, Kennedy, and Souter, that was designed in part to try to call the warring sides to a truce, to create space for recognition that pro-life forces could, from early on in the course of a pregnancy, have their views be expressed, but have the final decision, at least up until the point of viability, belong to the pregnant woman. Whereas after viability, the state had broad powers to regulate, and so pro-life forces could have their political will expressed through laws that prohibited abortions, except in cases where necessary to protect or preserve a pregnant woman's life or health, broadly understood. And the idea was both sides were getting something quite important. Pregnant women prior to viability were getting broad protections in the final decision, and pro-life forces were getting sort of the ability to express views pre-viability and to have their way after viability. The thought was that this would be a way of calling the warring sides to truth, to make sure that everybody saw that they could have their will and preferences expressed in and through politics to some degree. But as we know, that's been that wish, that hope, that dream, spectacular failure.
Is it because the pro-life believes that life begins at conception, and any abortion, even before the heartbeat is detected, is wrong and should be considered illegal? On the other hand, the pro-choice folks, the abortion rights supporters, say that ultimately it's the woman's right to choose what to do with her body and with the pregnancy.
Yeah, I mean,
at any time.
Yeah, I think sort of both sides have deeply, deeply held commitments and views reflective of different kinds of worldviews that are not things that people easily or readily give up, particularly when there are opportunities to express them in and through politics.
And it's hard to find a more divisive issue than abortion. I know you're a legal expert. You're not huge into the politics of it, but it defines Republicans and Democrats for the most part. I mean, there are some anti-abortion Democrats, but few. I mean, it is the dividing issue in modern day politics.
Yeah, I mean, along with questions of race, along with other questions that are sort of perennially sort of part of the national debate, you know, sort of abortion is certainly high up on that list. From a legal perspective, I think part of the question is what are the best ways to try to manage the political intensities and to try to get people to sort of turn down the heat a bit, which was the hope of that Casey decision. But, you know, sort of the heat sort of hasn't been turned down. And some of the efforts that have been afoot in Ohio and in other states to pass more legislation that is reflective of pro-life views, those have been movements that have been taken with an understanding of where the Supreme Court's case law is and with an eye to what the next move might be, which helps explain why sort of in earlier iterations, Ohio Right to Life was not fully in support and, as you were describing, in some ways working quietly against the heartbeat bill. But now with change in Supreme Court composition, position and different possibilities opening up on the Supreme Court, different positions can be taken. These forms of legislation are being seen now as vehicles for bringing cases. And it's an interesting sort of shift in the mindset. It's changing sort of attitudes that once were about legislators and other lawmakers really sort of paying respects to constitutional decisions that the Supreme Court had handed down. Now legislation is not just in the abortion rights area, but in other areas, understood with some degree of regularity to be about what ways can we use legislation and use our power in the state legislature on the legislature's part to bring about changes in national constitutional law.
State laws that are admittedly and knowingly unconstitutional when they're passed, it's done so just to challenge existing precedent. Getting back to Ohio's law, where does this fit in the context of the Ohio bill, I should say, not law. Where does this fit in the context of efforts around the country? We've heard that this law would be one of the strictest in the country. Similar bills to the heartbeat bill have been put on hold by federal courts in other states. Help us understand where Ohio's anti-abortion efforts fit nationwide.
Well, I mean, I think depending on one's perspective, positively or negatively, at the forefront of movements across the nation to try to pass legislation that is both at odds with and undertaken with an effort to try to cut back on the Supreme Court's existing protections for abortion rights. But I think sort of there's an understanding that Ohio is taking a kind of leadership role in some of these national debates about abortion rights. And I think it's significant that it is doing so just sort of given the political stance of Ohio and its role sort of in national political debates. If things can happen in Ohio, then the thought is it's sort of representing a kind of shift across the nation.
We're viewed as a purple state.
Yeah.
You mentioned the Casey decision. They hope this would end the debate or at least quiet the debate or send both sides back to their corners at least. Is there a way legally, do you see, that could do that? In this day and age, is there a way that a Supreme Court decision using a part of the Constitution, the way it's written, that could end the political debate or quiet it considerably?
I don't think experience indicates that there's any reason to be hopeful about that. So it seems likely that no matter what the Supreme Court ultimately sort of continues to decide on questions of abortion rights or reproductive justice more generally or on the right to life, no matter what the Supreme Court decides, there's going to be intensely fraught political contest around the decision or decisions and efforts to sort of change course and to change law in the states. I mean, you have interesting sort of things happening in national politics. I'm sure you're watching really closely, whether it's in New York State or in Virginia, sort of as it's happening. And sort of it's really interesting to see sort of what happens in states where there are efforts to liberalize state abortion restrictions and what the political press back is.
Is that the solution, to kick it back to the states, let the states decide?
Well, I mean, I think that for many people is the fear. I mean, that's a possible outcome. From a certain point of view, there's a question about what a pro-life perspective on life ought to imply for constitutional purposes. For a long time, it's been regarded as the case that the conservative position was just to say Roe against Wade and its progeny were wrongly decided. And so we ought to get them off of the books. And that's what constitutional fidelity would mean. Leave it up to the political arena to decide the question. But if you actually are of the view that a fetus, from the moment of conception on, there's a life, and that the Constitution protects a right to life, it's not clear why that position doesn't suggest that laws allowing abortions themselves raise constitutional questions to the extent that they're authorizing life to be deprived without due process.
Mark Spendelman, a law professor at Ohio State, here to talk about the issue of abortion, which, as we've said, will likely not go away in American politics anytime soon. Mark, thanks for coming on Snollygoster.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks.
Let's get to our newest segment. It's called the Snollygoster of the Week, the politician who proudly displays his or her shrewd self-interest. And this week it is State Representative Niraj Antani, who took the oath of office for his new term less than 1 month ago.
I'm very excited to announce that in 2020, I will be running for state senator for the Ohio Senate 6th District.
That's right. The third-term Republican from the Dayton area is already a lame duck, and he's already looking for his next job.
This position is incredibly important for Dayton, for the suburbs of Dayton, and for the Dayton region.
You know who else this district is important to?
Who?
Him! Apparently, Representative Antani will face a tough primary opponent. Representative Jim Butler, also of the Dayton area. Jim Oddy from WHIO-TV and the Dayton Daily News, who graciously gave us that audio, says it's going to be a barn burner, with each candidate having to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars to win a Senate seat, a state Senate seat. It's just amazing.
You know who else that district is important to? The voters who just elected Niraj Antani to represent them.
Well, he's still going to represent them.
Yeah, but now he's running for office a week into his new term.
Well,
Niraj Antani.
Thus, he is our Snollygoster of the week.
He also presented that that new vicious dogs bill. He wants to punish owners of vicious dogs, which seems like an altruistic thing to do.
Not a Snollygoster
thing to do. But
unless you're a vicious dog.
Unless you're a vicious dog. It's not. All right. Niraj Antani, congrats. You are our Snollygoster of the Week. If you have a suggestion for next week's Snollygoster of the Week, send us an email to snollygoster@wosu.org. Also, leave us a good review on iTunes. Tell your buddies about us. Whatever it is you can do to get the word out. Tell dogs about us. I don't think dogs can.
Yeah, we don't want vicious dogs.
They can't subscribe on iTunes anyway.
Keep the volume really low, though.
They couldn't touch a phone with their little paw. Until next week, I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Mike Thompson for Snollygoster from WOSU Public Media.